The Painted Veil by W. Somerset Maugham. Read by Sophie Ward. Chapter 1. She gave a startled cry.
"What's the matter?" he asked.
Notwithstanding the darkness of the shuttered room, he saw her face, on a sudden, distraught with terror. "Someone just tried the door."
"Well, perhaps it was the armor or one of the boys."
"They never come at this time. They know I always sleep after tiffin."
"Who else could it be?"
"Walter," she whispered, her lips trembling. She pointed to his shoes. He tried to put them on, but his nervousness, for her alarm was affecting him, made him clumsy, and besides, they were on the tight side. With a faint gasp of impatience, she gave him a shoehorn. She slipped into a kimono and in her bare feet went over to her dressing table. Her hair was shingled, and with a comb she had repaired its disorder before he had laced his second shoe. She handed him his coat.
"How shall I get out?"
"You'd better wait a bit. I'll look out and see that it's all right."
"It can't possibly be Walter. He doesn't leave the laboratory till 5.
"Who is it, then?" They spoke in whispers now. She was quaking. It occurred to him that in an emergency she would lose her head, and on a sudden he felt angry with her. If it wasn't safe, why the devil had she said it was? She caught her breath and put her hand on his arm. He followed the direction of her glance. They stood facing the windows that led out on the veranda. They were shuttered, and the shutters were bolted. They saw the white china knob of the handle slowly turn. They had heard no one walk along the veranda. It was terrifying to see that silent motion. A minute passed, and there was no sound. Then, with the ghastliness of the supernatural, in the same stealthy, noiseless, and horrifying manner, they saw the white china knob of the handle at the other window turn also. It was so frightening that Kitty, her nerves failing her, opened her mouth to scream. But seeing what she was going to do, he swiftly put his hand over it, and her cry was smothered in his fingers. Silence. She leaned against him, her knees shaking, and he was afraid she would faint. Frowning, his jaw set, he carried her to the bed and sat her down upon it. She was as white as the sheet, and notwithstanding his tan, his cheeks were pale too. He stood by her side looking with fascinated gaze at the china knob. They did not speak. Then he saw that she was crying. "For God's sake, don't do that," he whispered irritably. "If we're in for it, we're in for it. We shall just have to brazen it out." She looked for her handkerchief, and knowing what she wanted, he gave her her bag.
"Where's your topi?"
"I left it downstairs."
"Oh, my God!"
"I say, you must pull yourself together. It's 100 to 1 it wasn't Walter. Why on earth should he come back at this hour? He never does come home in the middle of the day, does he?"
"Never."
"I'll bet you anything you like it was the armor."
She gave him the shadow of a smile. His rich, caressing voice reassured her, and she took his hand and affectionately pressed it. He gave her a moment to collect herself.
"Look here, we can't stay here forever," he said then. "Do you feel up to going out on the veranda and having a look?"
"I don't think I can stand."
"Have you got any brandy in here?"
She shook her head. A frown for an instant darkened his brow. He was growing impatient. He did not quite know what to do. Suddenly she clutched his hand more tightly.
"Suppose he's waiting there?"
He forced his lips to smile, and his voice retained the gentle, persuasive tone, the effect of which he was so fully conscious of.
"That's not very likely. Have a little pluck, Kitty. How can it possibly be your husband? If he'd come in and seen a strange topi in the hall and come upstairs and found your room locked, surely he would have made some sort of row. It must have been one of the servants. Only a Chinese would turn a handle in that way."
She did feel more herself now. "It's not very pleasant, even if it was only the armor."
"She can be squared, and if necessary, I'll put the fear of God into her. There are not many advantages in being a government official, but you may as well get what you can out of it."
He must be right. She stood up, and turning to him, stretched out her arms. He took her in his and kissed her on the lips. It was such rapture that it was pain. She adored him. He released her, and she went to the window. She slid back the bolt, and opening the shutter a little, looked out. There was not a soul. She slipped onto the veranda, looked into her husband's dressing room, and then into her own sitting room. Both were empty. She went back to the bedroom and beckoned to him. Nobody.
I believe the whole thing was an optical delusion.
Don't laugh. I was terrified. Go into my sitting room and sit down. I'll put on my stockings and some shoes. Chapter 2. He did as she bade, and in 5 minutes she joined him. He was smoking a cigarette.
I say, could I have a brandy and soda?
Yes, I'll ring.
I don't think it would hurt you by the look of things.
They waited in silence for the boy to answer. She gave the order. Ring up the laboratory and ask if Walter is there, she said then. They won't know your voice.
He took up the receiver and asked for the number. He inquired whether Dr. Fane was in. He put down the receiver. He hasn't been in since tiffin, he told her. Ask the boy whether he's been here.
I daren't. It'll look so funny if he has, and I didn't see him.
The boy brought the drinks, and Townsend helped himself. When he offered her some, she shook her head.
What's to be done if it was Walter? She asked.
Perhaps he wouldn't care.
Walter?
Her tone was incredulous. It's always struck me he was rather shy. Some men can't bear scenes, you know. He's got sense enough to know that there's nothing to be gained by making a scandal. I don't believe for a minute it was Walter, but even if it was, my impression is that he'll do nothing. I think he'll ignore it.
She reflected for a moment. He's awfully in love with me.
Well, that's all to the good. You'll get round him.
He gave her that charming smile of his, which she had always found so irresistible. It was a slow smile, which started in his clear blue eyes and travelled by perceptible degrees to his shapely mouth. He had small, white, even teeth. It was a very sensual smile, and it made her heart melt in her body. I don't very much care, she said, with a flash of gaiety. It was worth it.
It was my fault.
Why did you come? I was amazed to see you.
I couldn't resist it.
You dear. She leaned a little towards him, her dark and shining eyes gazing passionately into his, her mouth a little open with desire, and he put his arms round her. She abandoned herself with a sigh of ecstasy to their shelter.
You know you can always count on me, he said.
I'm so happy with you. I wish I could make you as happy as you make me.
You're not frightened anymore.
I hate Walter, she answered. He did not quite know what to say to this, so he kissed her. Her face was very soft against his. But he took her wrist, on which was a little gold watch, and looked at the time.
Do you know what I must do now?
Bolt? She smiled. He nodded. For one instant she clung to him more closely, but she felt his desire to go, and she released him. It's shameful the way you neglect your work. Be off with you.
He could never resist the temptation to flirt. You seem in a devil of a hurry to get rid of me, he said lightly.
You know that I hate to let you go. Her answer was low and deep and serious. He gave a flattered laugh.
Don't worry your pretty little head about our mysterious visitor. I'm quite sure it was the armour, and if there's any trouble, I guarantee to get you out of it.
Have you had a lot of experience?
His smile was amused and complacent. No, but I flatter myself that I've got a head screwed on my shoulders.
Chapter 3. She went out onto the veranda and watched him leave the house. He waved his hand to her. It gave her a little thrill as she looked at him. He was 41, but he had the lithe figure and the springing step of a boy. The veranda was in shadow, and lazily, her heart at ease with satisfied love, she lingered. Their house stood in the Happy Valley, on the side of the hill,
for they could not afford to live on the more eligible but expensive Peak. But her abstracted gaze scarcely noticed the blue sea and the crowded shipping in the harbour. She could think only of her lover. Of course it was stupid to behave as they had done that afternoon, but if he wanted her, how could she be prudent? He had come two or three times after tiffin, when in the heat of the day no one thought of stirring out, and not even the boys had seen him come and go. It was very difficult at Hong Kong. She hated the Chinese city, and it made her nervous to go into the filthy little house off the Victoria Road in which they were in the habit of meeting. It was a curio dealer's, and the Chinese who were sitting about stared at her unpleasantly. She hated the ingratiating smile of the old man who took her to the back of the shop and then up a dark flight of stairs. The room into which he led her was frowsy, and the large wooden bed against the wall made her shudder. "This is dreadfully sordid, isn't it?" she said to Charlie the first time she met him there.
"It was till you came in," he answered.
Of course, the moment he took her in his arms, she forgot everything. Oh, how hateful it was that she wasn't free, that they both weren't free. She didn't like his wife. Kitty's wandering thoughts dwelt now for a moment on Dorothy Townsend. How unfortunate to be called Dorothy. It dated you. She was 38 at least. But Charlie never spoke of her. Of course, he didn't care for her. She bored him to death. But he was a gentleman. Kitty smiled with affectionate irony. It was just like him, silly old thing. He might be unfaithful to her, but he would never allow a word in disparagement of her to cross his lips. She was a tallish woman, taller than Kitty, neither stout nor thin, with a good deal of pale brown hair. She could never have been pretty with anything but the prettiness of youth. Her features were good enough without being remarkable, and her blue eyes were cold. She had a skin that you would never look at twice, and no colour in her cheeks. And she dressed like, well, like what she was, the wife of the assistant colonial secretary at Hong Kong. Kitty smiled and gave her shoulders a faint shrug. Of course, no one could deny that Dorothy Townsend had a pleasant voice. She was a wonderful mother. Charlie always said that of her. And she was what Kitty's mother called a gentlewoman. But Kitty did not like her. She did not like her casual manner. And the politeness with which she treated you when you went there to tea or dinner was exasperating, because you could not but feel how little interest she took in you. The fact was, Kitty supposed, that she cared for nothing but her children. There were two boys at school in England, and another boy of six whom she was going to take home next year. Her face was a mask. She smiled, and in her pleasant, well-mannered way said the things that were expected of her, but for all her cordiality, held you at a distance. She had a few intimate friends in the colony, and they greatly admired her. Kitty wondered whether Mrs. Townsend thought her a little common. She flushed. After all, there was no reason for her to put on airs. It was true that her father had been a colonial governor, and of course it was very grand while it lasted. Everyone stood up when you entered a room, and men took off their hats to you as you passed in your car. But what could be more insignificant than a colonial governor when he had retired? Dorothy Townsend's father lived on a pension in a small house at Earl's Court. Kitty's mother would think it a dreadful bore if she asked her to call. Kitty's father, Bernard Garstin, was a KC, and there was no reason why he should not be made a judge one of these days. Anyhow, they lived in South Kensington. Chapter 4. Kitty, coming to Hong Kong on her marriage, had found it hard to reconcile herself to the fact that her social position was determined by her husband's occupation. Of course, everyone had been very kind, and for two or three months they had gone out to parties almost every night. When they dined at Government House, the governor took her in as a bride, but she had understood quickly that as the wife of the government bacteriologist, she was of no particular consequence. It made her angry. "It's too absurd," she told her husband. "Why, there's hardly anyone here that one would bother about for 5 minutes at home. Mother wouldn't dream of asking any of them to dine at our house." "You mustn't let it worry you," he answered. "It doesn't really matter, you know." "Of course it doesn't matter. It only shows how stupid they are. But it is rather funny when you think of all the people who used to come to our house at home, that here we should be treated like dirt. From a social standpoint, the man of science does not exist. He smiled. She knew that now, but she had not known it when she married him. I don't know that it exactly amuses me to be taken into dinner by the agent of the P&O, she said, laughing, in order that what she said might not seem snobbish. Perhaps he saw the reproach behind her lightness of manner, for he took her hand and shyly pressed it. I'm awfully sorry, Kitty dear, but don't let it vex you. Oh, I'm not going to let it do that. Chapter 5. It couldn't have been Walter that afternoon. It must have been one of the servants, and after all, they didn't matter. Chinese servants knew everything anyway, but they held their tongues. Her heart beat a little faster as she remembered the way in which that white china knob slowly turned. They mustn't take risks like that again. It was better to go to the curio shop. No one who saw her go in would think anything of it, and they were absolutely safe there. The owner of the shop knew who Charlie was, and he was not such a fool as to put up the back of the assistant colonial secretary. What did anything matter, really, but that Charlie loved her? She turned away from the veranda and went back into her sitting room. She threw herself down on the sofa and stretched out her hand to get a cigarette. Her eye caught sight of a note lying on the top of a book. She opened it. It was written in pencil. Dear Kitty, here is the book you wanted. I was just going to send it when I met Dr. Fane, and he said he'd bring it round himself as he was passing the house. V.H. She rang the bell, and when the boy came, asked him who had brought the book and when. Master bring it, missy, after tiffin, he answered. Then it had been Walter. She rang up the colonial secretary's office at once and asked for Charlie. She told him what she had just learned. There was a pause before he answered. What shall I do? She asked. I'm in the middle of an important consultation. I'm afraid I can't talk to you now. My advice to you is to sit tight. She put down the receiver. She understood that he was not alone, and she was impatient with his business. She sat down again, at a desk, and resting her face in her hand, sought to think out the situation. Of course, Walter might merely have thought she was sleeping. There was no reason why she should not lock herself in. She tried to remember if they had been talking. Certainly they had not been talking loud. And there was the hat. It was maddening of Charlie to have left it downstairs. But it was no use blaming him for that. It was natural enough, and there was nothing to tell that Walter had noticed it. He was probably in a hurry and had just left the book and note on his way to some appointment connected with his work. The strange thing was that he should have tried the door and then the two windows. If he thought she was asleep, it was unlike him to disturb her. What a fool she had been. She shook herself a little, and again she felt that sweet pain in her heart, which she always felt when she thought of Charlie. It had been worth it. He had said that he would stand by her, and if the worst came to the worst, well, let Walter kick up a row if he chose. She had Charlie. What did she care? Perhaps it would be the best thing for him to know. She had never cared for Walter, and since she had loved Charlie Townsend, it had irked and bored her to submit to her husband's caresses. She wanted to have nothing more to do with him. She didn't see how he could prove anything. If he accused her, she would deny. And if it came to a pass that she could deny no longer, well, she would fling the truth in his teeth, and he could do what he chose. Chapter 6. Within 3 months of her marriage, she knew that she had made a mistake, but it had been her mother's fault even more than hers. There was a photograph of her mother in the room, and Kitty's harassed eyes fell on it. She did not know why she kept it there, for she was not very fond of her mother. There was one of her father, too, but that was downstairs on the grand piano. It had been done when he took silk, and it represented him in a wig and gown. Even they could not make him imposing. He was a little wizened man, with tired eyes, a long upper lip, and a thin mouth.
A facetious photographer had told him to look pleasant, but he had succeeded only in looking severe. It was on this account, for as a rule the downturned corners of his mouth and the dejection of his eyes gave him an air of mild depression, that Mrs. Garstin, thinking it made him look judicial, had chosen it from among the proofs. But her own photograph showed her in the dress in which she had gone to court when her husband was made a king's counsel. She was very grand in the velvet gown, the long train so disposed as to show to advantage, with feathers in her hair and flowers in her hand. She held herself erect. She was a woman of 50, thin and flat-chested, with prominent cheekbones and a large, well-shaped nose. She had a great quantity of very smooth black hair, and Kitty had always suspected that, if not dyed, it was at least touched up. Her fine black eyes were never still, and this was the most noticeable thing about her, for when she was talking to you, it was disconcerting to see those restless eyes in that impassive, unlined and yellow face. They moved from one part of you to another, to other persons in the room, and then back to you. You felt that she was criticizing you, summing you up, watchful, meanwhile, of all that went on around her, and that the words she spoke had no connection with her thoughts. Chapter 7. Mrs. Garstin was a hard, cruel, managing, ambitious, parsimonious, and stupid woman. She was the daughter, one of five, of a solicitor in Liverpool, and Bernard Garstin had met her when he was on the Northern Circuit. He had seemed then a young man of promise, and her father said he would go far. He hadn't. He was painstaking, industrious, and capable, but he had not the will to advance himself. Mrs. Garstin despised him. But she recognized, though with bitterness, that she could only achieve success through him, and she set herself to drive him on the way she desired to go. She nagged him without mercy. She discovered that if she wanted him to do something which his sensitiveness revolted against, she had only to give him no peace, and eventually, exhausted, he would yield. On her side, she set herself to cultivate the people who might be useful. She flattered the solicitors who would send her husband briefs, and was familiar with their wives. She was obsequious to the judges and their ladies. She made much of promising politicians. In 25 years, Mrs. Garstin never invited anyone to dine at her house because she liked him. She gave large dinner parties at regular intervals, but parsimony was as strong in her as ambition. She hated to spend money. She flattered herself that she could make as much show as anyone else at half the price. Her dinners were long and elaborate, but thrifty, and she could never persuade herself that people, when they were eating and talking, knew what they drank. She wrapped sparkling Moselle in a napkin and thought her guests took it for champagne. Bernard Garstin had a fair, though not a large, practice. Men who had been called after him had long outstripped him. Mrs. Garstin made him stand for Parliament. The expense of the election was borne by the party, but here again her parsimony balked her ambition, and she could not bring herself to spend enough money to nurse the constituency. The subscriptions Bernard Garstin made to the innumerable funds a candidate is expected to contribute to were always just a little less than adequate. He was beaten. Though it would have pleased Mrs. Garstin to be a member's wife, she bore her disappointment with fortitude. The fact of her husband's standing had brought her in contact with a number of prominent persons, and she appreciated the addition to her social consequence. She knew that Bernard would never make his mark in the House. She wanted him to be a member only that he might have a claim on the gratitude of his party, and surely to fight two or three losing seats would give him that. But he was still a junior, and many younger men than he had already taken silk. It was necessary that he should too, not only because otherwise he could scarcely hope to be made a judge, but on her account also. It mortified her to go into dinner after women 10 years younger than herself. But here she encountered in her husband an obstinacy which she had not for years been accustomed to. He was afraid that as a KC he would get no work. A bird in the hand was worth two in the bush, he told her, to which she retorted that a proverb was the last refuge of the mentally destitute. He suggested to her the possibility that his income would be halved, and he knew that there was no argument which could have greater weight with her. She would not listen. She called him pusillanimous. She gave him no peace, and at last, as always, he yielded. He applied for silk, and it was promptly awarded him. His misgivings were justified. He made no headway as a leader, and his briefs were few. But he concealed any disappointment he may have felt, and if he reproached his wife, it was in his heart. He grew perhaps a little more silent, but he had always been silent at home, and no one in his family noticed a change in him. His daughters had never looked upon him as anything but a source of income. It had always seemed perfectly natural that he should lead a dog's life in order to provide them with board and lodging, clothes, holidays, and money for odds and ends. And now, understanding that through his fault money was less plentiful, the indifference they had felt for him was tinged with an exasperated contempt. It never occurred to them to ask themselves what were the feelings of the subdued little man who went out early in the morning and came home at night only in time to dress for dinner. He was a stranger to them, but because he was their father, they took it for granted that he should love and cherish them. Chapter 8. But there was a quality of courage in Mrs. Garstin, which in itself was admirable. She let no one in her immediate circle, which to her was the world, see how mortified she was by the frustration of her hopes. She made no change in her style of living. By careful management, she was able to give as showy dinners as she had done before, and she met her friends with the same bright gaiety which she had so long cultivated. She had a hard and facile fund of chit-chat, which in the society she moved in passed for conversation. She was a useful guest among persons to whom small talk did not come easily, for she was never at a loss with a new topic, and could be trusted immediately to break an awkward silence with a suitable observation. It was unlikely now that Bernard Garstin would ever be made a judge of the High Court, but he might still hope for a county court judgeship, or at the worst, an appointment in the colonies. Meanwhile, she had the satisfaction of seeing him appointed recorder of a Welsh town. But it was on her daughters that she set her hopes. By arranging good marriages for them, she expected to make up for all the disappointments of her career. There were two, Kitty and Doris. Doris gave no sign of good looks. Her nose was too long and her figure was lumpy, so that Mrs. Garstin could hope no more for her than that she should marry a young man who was well off in a suitable profession. End of Side 1.